From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Pulitzer Prize finalists and winners are still basking in the glow of the prize announcements made earlier this week. Today, we meet those with Georgia ties who are being honored. We'll also hear from a past winner, but first, we talked about the Stroke Belt, an 11-state southern region where stroke risk is much higher than in the rest of the country. There's a new initiative in Georgia to tackle the problem. This multi-million dollar partnership brings together several universities and hospitals in the state. We asked what you think about this initiative, and here are your first thoughts.
Hi, this is Rick Weisinger from Savannah, Georgia. My comment is, this new stroke initiative is a day late and a dollar short. It just contributes to the medicalization of preventable problems. We need interventions that reduce the reasons people have strokes to begin with, such as obesity, a high animal fat, high salt diet, and inactivity.
Thanks, Rick, for your comments. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page, and we might feature your comments on the show. One of the runners-up for the Pulitzer Prizes announced this week is a familiar name to a lot of you. Renee Montaigne was a longtime host of NPR's Morning Edition until 2016. These days, she is a special correspondent for the network, and her series on maternal deaths was produced in partnership with ProPublica. The members of that reporting team are finalists for the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. The series sheds light on a troubling discrepancy in maternal deaths. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at least 700 mothers die in the United States every year as a result of pregnancy or childbirth complications, and Black women are by far at a greater risk. My colleague Celeste Headley talked with Renee Montaigne about her reporting in Georgia.
One of the people that you spoke to during this investigation was the mother of Wanda, of Shalon Irving, of Sandy Springs, Georgia, here in our own state. She died from complications of childbirth, and of course, her death came after the birth.
It was a great birth. It was just a beautiful time. So the problem didn't come in until after the birth, and she didn't have an afterbirth plan.
How common is it for new mothers to not have what's called an afterbirth plan?
You know, it is very common. In fact, it would be uncommon for a mother to have an afterbirth plan that would be about her own health. There are lots of afterbirth plans women and their husbands, their partners spend all kinds of time planning for, you know, the crib, the room, the baby's health, the party. I mean, there's lots of plans that are in place for afterbirth. But it is very unusual for people to look at the afterbirth period as a sort of a medical period. A period where there is any possibility of complications as long as the birth itself went well. But the notion of postpartum care is very minimal in this country. There's no outreach for mothers after birth to speak of. It's almost like they systematically go from a healthcare system, that is the obstetricians and the constant and regular monitoring, to the birth in a hospital or maybe at home with midwives, something like that. But I mean, and then after that, they're in a whole other system. That's the pediatric system.
So let me give a few of the statistics that come from your report, the NPR's reporting and ProPublica's. 50,000 women a year experience serious complications or lose their lives during this period of time around birth. And serious complications more than doubled between 1993 and 2014, which means these kind of complications and deaths are on the rise in the U.S., while they're falling through the rest of the developed world. And Shalon's story, Shalon Irving of Georgia, actually brings us to the second part of this, which is, yes, maternal deaths are worse in the U.S. than other developed nations, but they're particularly bad for African-American women. Here is, again, Wanda, who is Shalon's mother.
There's a picture of her and Soleil with the same outfits that was taken the day she collapsed, the morning of the day she collapsed. Soleil is French for sun. She just lights up a room when she smiles. And she's the only reason I have for getting out of bed every morning.
It's so hard to listen to because, in fact, you know, that picture was indeed a picture of her and in their little outfits. And Shonda had not been doing so great after birth. She had mastered the whole pregnancy very well and shot right through it, even though she had a blood clotting disease that was under control. She had a history of hypertension, but that was under control even without drugs. She was overweight. But there were lots of things going on with her, but she could not survive. And the thing that we're trying to bring out with her was if she couldn't make it, and she's a black woman, and black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. It's an astonishing, horrifying statistic. If she couldn't survive, what occurred afterwards, she died of hypertension, according to an autopsy. Pretty much what happened to her would have happened to a white woman, as we are finding out, in her situation. That is to say, she got a certain amount of attention, but not enough. And in the end, you know, attention wasn't paid to what was wrong with her. But why she couldn't survive that comes down to certain things, and one of that had to do with something called aging, that is being studied and suggesting that, and the suggestion that a lifetime of stress can age your body in a way that a black woman pregnant at 35 would correlate to a white woman pregnant in her 40s. And right there, you have a real problem.
That's NPR correspondent Renee Montaigne. Her investigation with ProPublica on maternal deaths was honored this week as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. This week, Pulitzer Prize finalists and winners were announced, and you're hearing some of those honored who have ties to Georgia. Yale Law School professor James Forman Jr. won this year's Pulitzer for nonfiction for his book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. It explores why so many young men of color wind up in prison. Forman is a graduate of Atlanta's Roosevelt High, and his father was a leader of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley spoke with James Forman Jr. last year.
Let's start with your dad. One of the stories that he repeated often was after he got, after he left the Air Force, he was pulled over. He was studying. He was going to USC at the time, I think. He was studying late. He was pulled over by police because there had been a robbery, and they said he was suspicious. He was apprehended anyway, arrested, I think. And he described that event as being so dramatic and traumatic, he had to seek therapy for it. And I wonder how much of your dad's experience ended up in your research for this book.
Well, I think a lot of it. I mean, his life, right? Your parents, they pass on their messages. They pass on their stories at the dinner table. And in one way, growing up in Atlanta, I had the benefit, and my generation had the benefit of the successes of his generation, because, you know, we didn't necessarily have to deal with an all-white police force like the sort that he had to deal with growing up in Los Angeles. And we had opportunities, right? That generation, the civil rights generation, they made it possible for people of my generation to have access to jobs that were, you know, impossible to imagine to a black man of my dad's generation. But at the same time, I could still see a lot of those perpetuation of those policing practices that he had described. It's just that now it was more complicated because now we had a lot of African American officers, right? Growing up in Atlanta, we had a black police chief, we had a black mayor. But at the same time, there was a lot of really kind of damaging practices, and a lot of kids in my neighborhood grew up, you know, fearing the police. And so that's, I guess, some
both
of the complexity.
Both black and white.
Both black and white, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the issues of, once upon a time, we thought in this country that if we integrated the police departments, that would change policing practices. Martin Luther King Sr. gave a speech at Morehouse College in 1941 when there were no black officers in Atlanta. And he said, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. And the belief was that when the force was integrated, that the practices would change in poor communities and black communities. And what we saw was we got the integration, which was great, which we need, which we deserve, but a lot of the practices continued.
And you actually start the book with a story of a judge, an actual African-American judge, lecturing a kid that you were defending about how he has just basically trashed the entire legacy of the civil rights movement. That event seemed to have made a huge impression upon you. Why?
Well, so Brandon had pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana. He was facing sentencing in, as you said, with an African-American judge, and I was asking for him to be put on probation. And the judge not only didn't do that, the judge locked him up, but on the way to locking him up, he gave him this speech where he said, listen, Martin Luther King fought and died for your freedom. He fought and died for change in America, and his fight was not for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and carrying that gun. And so for me, somebody who had become a public defender because I viewed it as the civil rights issue of my generation, I viewed myself as carrying on my father's legacy, to go into court and have, you know, a black man representing a black client in front of a black judge and have that judge flip that civil rights history on its head and use it as a justification to lock up my client, I found incredibly demoralizing.
So I want to be clear to anyone who's listening that your book in no way claims that institutional racism is not a great deal at fault for their incarceration crisis in the United States, right?
That's absolutely right. And I'm glad you brought that up. No, I'm very clear throughout the book that structural and institutional racism has limited the options that were available to the African-American decision makers that I write about, right? I'm writing mainly about black police chiefs, black mayors, black judges, black police officers. But we don't operate in a vacuum, right? They operate within a structure. And so you see over and over again the way that racism limits their choices. They say, black decision makers say, we want more police and we want more prosecutors. But we also want more jobs. We want more money for education. We want money for housing. We want national gun control. We want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want the United States to invest in black communities the way it invested in Europe after World War II. But black leaders get none of that. For 50 years, they go to Congress asking for money for all of the above, and they come back for 50 years with money for one of the above. And the one of the above is law enforcement.
So let's go back to the war on crime. And there are certain eras in law enforcement trends, I guess. The war on crime was one of them. Broken windows policy was another one. And you are very careful about tracing, about talking about the majority African-American communities who also were part enthusiastic partners in the war on crime. Why?
Folks were desperate. Folks were scared. People wanted protection. So the homicide rate in this country doubled in the 1960s. It tripled in D.C. It more than doubled in Atlanta. And then in the 80s, in the early 90s, we get the crack epidemic, right? Which a lot of black leaders said, this is the worst thing to hit us since slavery. So when you have mothers who say, I can't take my kid to school because they're drug dealers on the corner, and I can't leave them in the park after school because they're selling drugs in the park and they're shooting in the park and I'm scared. And you have those folks reaching out to their elected officials, African-American elected officials in many cases in some of our big cities, and saying, we want protection.
That's Yale Law School professor James Forman Jr. He's author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. This week, James was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Pulitzer Prize winners and finalists were announced this week. We heard earlier this hour from two with ties to Georgia. Now, two past winners. Atlanta native Alfred Urey won the 1988 Pulitzer Prize for drama with his play Driving Miss Daisy. It was adapted, of course, into a film. I spoke to him in 2015 about another of his plays, Parade. It's the story of Leo Frank, a Jewish Georgian jailed for the murder of a 13-year-old girl and lynched in 1915 by a Marietta mob. To this day, there's debate about his guilt. I asked Alfred Urey what drew him to this story.
Well, the owner of the National Pencil Company was my mother's uncle. And then this all has happened years and years before I was born. But there was this deep silence about the Leo Frank case in my childhood in Atlanta. And I guess I wanted to know why. And I read about it. And I saw how incredibly dramatic and gripping the story is. And I knew it was theatrical. And then years later, it was suggested to me that I do a serious musical of it. And I jumped at the chance.
When you first saw a picture of Leo Frank, what went through your mind?
Shock, horror, disgust. A little 27-year-old, very thin man that looks sort of like Woody Allen, hanging from a tree, barefoot with a burlap sack wrapped around his waist. Pretty disturbing. And a bunch of people looking at the camera in sort of pride at having done this. My own particular family had been in Atlanta since before Atlanta was named Atlanta. They'd been an established part of the community here. And they had led a very interesting and productive life, and there had not been a lot of anti-Semitism until it was stirred up by the press because of this event.
The Leo Frank Research Library has requested a national inquiry into this case. Alfred, what is it about the story of Leo Frank that continues to be analyzed by legal scholars and historians? How have we not figured this out by now?
Because I think I'm not legal and I'm not a historian. But as far as I know, it's because nobody can prove exactly what happened because nobody else was there. And it pretty much stands to reason that this mild-mannered man didn't do this horrific crime. And 99.999% of me thinks that he was unjustly convicted and eventually lynched. But there's that little niggling strand of we don't know what happened. So it's endlessly interesting.
What did your family say when you told them that you were going to work on a play about Leo Frank?
Well, my mother, who was a small child when all this went on, was both delighted and horrified. But then when she saw the show, she said that she was glad that it was all brought to light and that she was glad I did it. And pretty much all of the Southern Jewish world has been happy to see it. And I think most Southerners, because don't forget, we were Jewish, but first we were Southerners. So the whole impact of what happened in this case isn't something that just affected Jews. It affected everybody in the South one way, and everybody was a victim. So there was a lot of broken hearts over this incident.
Alfred, I mean, Parade was a tough sell on Broadway. Why do you think that it didn't gain as much positive attention as your other works like Drive Amy Stacy?
Well, it had a big production, and it was worked on, but not enough. And we had the wonderful opportunity, Adam, of doing it about 8 years later in London in a revised production. And then that production went to L.A. and was a big hit there and has been performed all over this country. So I'm very happy that Parade has the life it has. And I have to mention the wonderful Jason Robert Brown, who wrote the songs, because they're brilliant, memorable songs.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Alfred Urey. His musical Parade is about the 1915 lynching of Leo Frank. Here's a scene from it.
When a man writes his mother every Sunday, pays his bills before they're due, works so hard to feed his family, there's your murderer for you. And you stand there spitting words that you know aren't true. But you don't know this man. I don't think you could. You don't have the right to know a man that wise and good. He is a decent man. He is an honest man. And you don't know.
Scene from the musical Parade by Pulitzer Prize-winning Atlanta native playwright Alfred Urey. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. We're spending the hour today with current and past Pulitzer Prize honorees with Georgia ties. Investigative journalist Bill Dedman won 1989's Investigative Reporting Pulitzer for his series on discriminatory lending practices of Atlanta's banks and mortgage lenders. His stories ran in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he told me about some of the takeaways from his reporting.
The main shock to people was that in the city known as the city too busy to hate, that the banks and largest savings and loan companies were making loans home loans in middle income and poor white neighborhoods, but not making loans in the middle or upper middle income or upper income black or integrated neighborhoods. The map of where the Atlanta banks weren't lending money and the map of where black people lived in Atlanta were the same map.
Right. And this is the practice known as redlining?
Yes. And redlining implies a conscious decision, someone drawing a line on a map. We lend on this side of the line and not on the other. And we didn't prove that there was a conscious intent. And we didn't, in fact, I credit the explanation of bankers that they just didn't know that there was money to be made in black neighborhoods in Atlanta. They had made an association, a common association, that black meant poor. My eyes were open. After our stories ran, I went along, bankers from Bank South let us go on a bus tour of some very affluent neighborhoods in South Atlanta. Guilford Forest was one. And you could tell, and the bankers were saying, hey, these kitchens are nicer than our kitchens. And they had no idea that these neighborhoods existed.
How did you collect the data to accomplish this piece of reporting?
Well, I could tell you about 8-inch floppy disks. It's been that long ago. You know, there had been a couple of academic studies in Baltimore and Philadelphia, and what we realized was that if they could do it, we could do it too. And banks had to report then, and other anybody else that got deposits, like a savings loan, had to report where they made loans by census tract, so you could match it up to the demographics. The key thing that we did was to not look at the poor areas and not look at the rich areas. We were looking at middle-income areas where people could afford homes. That was the key sort of decision that we made.
Why?
Well, because that was where it was comparable, and that was where you didn't have a debate about, well, can these people afford homes? There were homes being bought and sold by black Atlantans in those middle and upper-income neighborhoods. The market share, however, of the banks and the savings and loans was nearly zero.
How did you first get onto the story?
Well, you know, I was in a little neighborhood called South Atlanta with a Methodist minister. I was doing a story, probably the required story before the Democratic National Convention that year in 88. about, by the way, there are poor people in Atlanta. I was standing in a relatively poor neighborhood doing a story about housing. And the minister was doing, he was building houses and then selling them to people. And he said, but they can't get loans. People here can't get loans in this neighborhood, even though their mortgage payment will be far less than they've been paying in rent. And I said, well, gee, this doesn't look like such a prosperous neighborhood. To me, I don't, if I had any money, I don't think I'd lend any money here. And he said, well, I can see your point in a way, but the banks in Atlanta don't lend money in Cascade Heights either. In Hank Aaron's neighborhood. They don't lend money in Adams Park in an integrated neighborhood. And I said, well, I think that would be a story. So that's how it started.
And Bill, as a result of your reporting, or at least partially as a result of your reporting, some changes were made to the Federal Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, right?
Yes, yeah, so sort of all hell broke loose for a week or two there in Atlanta. You know, the we had marches, we had breakfasts with the bankers where politicians made hay calling them in to grill them. There was an effort to move some money into the black-owned banks in Atlanta, which did lend money in black neighborhoods and had practically a zero default rate. Then the Congress did change the law to increase disclosure of applications for loans. We had that information, for example, for the two biggest savings and loans in Atlanta. They were rejecting 5 or 10% of white applicants for home loans. That's people who've gone through the process, filled out an application, and they were rejecting 21 to 36% of black applicants. Now we have that information for every lender in America. So one of the things that this led to was more reporting by more journalists and think tanks and the Federal Reserve and others around the country, greater disclosure.
It's just a tremendous achievement for any investigative reporter, but it's particularly amazing when we consider the fact that you were 29 years old when you won the Pulitzer Prize. That must have been utterly life-changing. Do you remember the moment when you got the call?
Well, the main thing that stands out to me is that my son, I was just turned five. Justin had helped me color in the census tract map sitting on the floor of the art department at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, then on Marietta Street. And he misheard the announcement. And when he realized what we'd actually won, he was so upset because he thought we had won the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. And he was planning to buy the Atlanta Braves. That was his plan.
Bill Dedman is a senior investigative reporter at Newsday. As you just heard, he won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 1989 for his series on the discriminatory lending practices of Atlanta's bankers and bank executives, I should say, and the mortgage lenders as well. Bill, it's just been an honor to talk to you.
Thanks, Adam. It's a pleasure.